Hello, I'm Matthew, and welcome to this week's edition of the Black Country Talking News for the 26th of August, 2026.
Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by the sight loss charity Beacon. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. Once you've enabled the Talking Newspapers skill, all you need to do is play Talking Newspapers and ask for the Black Country Talking News. Our Talking News service is also available via the free Wireless for the Blind app. It can be found on the Beacon Centre website, www.beaconvision.org/talking-news, as a podcast via services such as Apple or Spotify, or as a free CD. Simply contact Beacon Centre on 01902 880 111. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
Reading for you this week, we have me, Matthew, Muhammad, Helen, Mina, Peter, Angela, Simon, and of course, Roger. In this week's edition, we have all the latest from Beacon with Helen and Muhammad. There's some fascinating news and nostalgia from across the Black Country, including the story of a new machine deeply rooted in Midlands engineering, which has been sent across the Atlantic in pursuit of another landmark in land speed history. It's full steam ahead as we hear all about the Severn Valley Railway's Summer Diesel Festival from our very own railway enthusiast, David Smith. You'll have to be sharp of mind, as we also have another quiz from Roger. We hear from Mina, who has the forecast for the week ahead. With thanks to Mina, we also have a sporting focus on the world of visually impaired cricket through the successes of the Cheshire Cobras. There's all the latest football news, including the weekend's action from Wolves and West Brom. In our brand new feature, we potter about in the garden with our very own Talking News contributor and volunteer, Peter. And with thanks to TNF Soundings contributor Liz, we have the final episode of a three-part series about one of our greatest storytellers and the author of Treasure Island, Robert Louis Stevenson. But first, it's local news with me, Matthew, Angela, and Peter.
After Richard Parker, the elected mayor for the West Midlands, announced last week that he was inviting bus operators to submit bids for the new rail-style franchises he's introducing in the West Midlands, the Prime Minister also announced that disabled people across England will be allowed to travel on buses free of charge at all times. Andy Burnham says the government will be lifting time restrictions on concessionary passes from the 1st of April next year, making it easier for disabled people to find jobs or access training. At the moment, disabled bus passes are only valid for travel from 9:30 a.m. to 11 p.m. during weekdays, unless local authorities choose to fund an extension. He says the government will be making £60 million available to remove these time restrictions across the whole of England, so that from next year, disabled bus pass holders can always travel free of charge, regardless of their postcode. Mr. Burnham said, "Buses are a lifeline for so many people, making it easier to get to work, education and healthcare. It's simply not right that many disabled people cannot travel using their pass during certain times of the day. So we're fixing that. Disabled people will now have unlimited free bus travel 24/7. The Prime Minister said he lifted the time restrictions in Greater Manchester during his time as mayor, was proud to be able to extend the scheme across the country. "This is part of our ongoing action to bring back hope and give people some much-needed breathing space on the cost of living." The Department of Works and Pensions will be providing £40 million of the funding, with the remainder coming from the transport budget. Work and Pensions Secretary Pat McFadden, who is MP for Wolverhampton South East, said, "For too long, disabled people have held a free bus pass in their pocket that didn't always get them to work. Now, we're changing that. By removing these time restrictions, we're helping disabled people access jobs, training, and other opportunities at any time of the day. Alongside our $3.5 billion investment in tailored employment support, this change shows we're serious about breaking down the barriers that have held disabled people back for too long. Transport Secretary Heidi Alexander added, "We're putting an end to this postcode lottery, so disabled people can travel on buses for free whenever they need, wherever they live, unlocking opportunities and access to jobs, learning and more. We're making this change because we've listened to disabled people and we know the importance of buses to local communities. These passes are a lifeline for so many, helping them stay connected and get to work and appointments, and it's only right they receive the same treatment no matter their postcard." The announcement has been welcomed by John Sparks, Chief Executive of Learning Disability MenCap. "This is welcome relief for disabled people struggling with the cost of living, as well as the extra costs of being disabled," he said. "Most importantly, though, it removes the inference that disabled people can't or shouldn't work. Disabled people should have the same opportunities as anyone else to work or to contribute to society in some other way, and this will help level that playing field." James Taylor of the Scope charity added, "Disabled people face extra costs every day, and many need to travel in the morning for work, education, and healthcare. Making free bus travel available around the clock is a welcome step that will put money back in people's pockets and remove barriers to everyday life." Lydia Horbury, Chief Executive of Bus Users UK, said, "Disabled people don't live off-peak lives. Lifting these restrictions nationwide replaces an arbitrary postcode lottery with genuine freedom, independence and dignity. It will help more disabled people access work, reduce isolation, support bus use and reduce unnecessary car dependency." Now then, talking of cars, almost a century after Wolverhampton's Sunbeam Slug became the first car to break 200 miles per hour, a new machine with deep Midlands roots has carried that same restless engineering spirit onto the Salt. The Black Country and Staffordshire have long been places where industrial grit becomes invention. From chains, iron and engines, to heavy machinery built for the world. In the JCB Hydromax, that heritage has taken a modern form. A 32-foot hydrogen-powered streamliner, conceived and prepared at extraordinary pace and sent to Bonneville in pursuit of another landmark in land speed history. The JCB Hydromax has now written its name into the record books, setting a new provisional FIA world land speed record for a hydrogen internal combustion powered vehicle at the Bonneville Salt Flats. Driven by Wing Commander Andy Green OBE, the 32-foot twin-engine streamliner recorded an average speed of 406.320 miles per hour, that is 653.909 kilometres per hour, across the flying mile, after completing the two runs required under FIA rules, one in each direction within an hour. The achievement comfortably surpasses the previous FIA-recognised hydrogen internal combustion benchmark of 185.5 miles an hour set by BMW's H2R in 2004, and also eclipses JCB's own diesel land speed record of 350.092 miles per hour set by the JCB diesel max at Bonneville in 2006. The FIA has confirmed the new provisional record, which remains subject to final ratification by the FIA Land Speed Records Commission. The Hydromax had already signalled its potential during Bonneville Speed Week when it set a Southern California Timing Association class record of 368.347 miles per hour in the blown glass streamliner category. The Hydromax is powered by two production-based hydrogen engines which, together, provide 1,600 brake horsepower. Many elements of the high-speed vehicle are used in JCB's production models too, with the Hydromax's crankshaft, for example, being used on JCB's 448 hydrogen and diesel engines. JCB Chairman Lord Bamford said, 20 years ago we came to Bonneville with JCB Dieselmax and showed what British engineering could do with diesel power. Today we've done it again, this time with engines powered by hydrogen. This record was set by production-based engines, the same engines powering JCB diggers right now. That is the point of JCB Hydromax. It shows hydrogen works, and it works today at the highest level with zero emissions. Across generations, the Black Country has learned how to turn weight into motion and industry into ambition. On the salt at Bonneville, the Hydromax seemed to carry that whole inheritance with it. The spark of the old furnaces, the precision of the workshops, and the enduring belief that the machines may have changed, but the impulse remains to build boldly, push harder, and leave a line across history.
Up next, we have the Beacon Update, brought to us by Mohammed.
Hey everyone, it's Mo from Beacon with your latest update. We'll start this week with a big thank you to everyone who welcomed us at Dudley's Sen Club at Fenspool Community Centre. It was lovely for Beacon to be part of such a welcoming and inclusive afternoon where we had the opportunity to meet families and chat about the support, activities and opportunities we offer for children and young people living with disabilities. We'd also like to say a massive thank you to Sonia Kumar MP for joining us. Visiting Beacon Centre beforehand to meet the team and learn more about our work before heading over to Fenspool to meet families and hear their questions. A huge thank you to everyone who came along and made us feel so welcome. We really enjoyed being part of the afternoon and look forward to continuing to support opportunities like this in our local community. Next up, our legacy tree is continuing to bloom here at Beacon. As part of Legacy Month, we've been asking people to reflect on what they'd like to be remembered for, their favourite memories and the things that make them happy. Our tree is already filling up with some really lovely contributions from our members and from our visitors. People have shared everything from wanting to be remembered for having a good heart, their career, their achievements, to wedding days, meeting a partner, having children, and treasured time with family and friends. One person shared that making friends through our lifestyle centre is something that makes them very happy. Others said they wanted to be remembered for being kind, having a good heart, and being helpful, while another wanted to be remembered as a good nurse who always puts their patients first. We'd love for you to add to the tree. Simply drop into the centre and add your own leaf to the tree, which is at reception, or let us know on our Facebook comments and we can do it for you. We're also proud to support Glaucoma UK's National Patient Voices Survey, helping people living with glaucoma or those being monitored for glaucoma to share their experiences and help shape the future of care. If this applies to you, Beacon would love for you to take part to make sure local voices are heard. The survey is completely voluntary. Your responses will be anonymized, and it takes approximately 20 minutes to complete. The survey closes on Monday, the 31st of August. You can take part online, and the link has been shared on our Facebook page. If you require any help or prefer a paper copy, you can call 01233557207 or email voice@glaucoma.uk. Next, we want to say a huge congratulations to the England Blind Men's Football Team. Following their fantastic run at the IBSA Blind Euros, England reached the final after an incredible tournament, eventually finishing as runners-up after losing to France in the final. It was a brilliant achievement, and everyone at Beacon is incredibly proud of the team and the effort they put in throughout the competition. We'd also like to give a special mention to our former superstar, Issa, who was previously a finance intern here at Beacon. Issa, we're incredibly proud of you and everything you've achieved. Congratulations to the whole England team on an amazing tournament and good luck for the future. And finally, with the new football season underway, we wanted to remind you that if you're struggling to read the TV guide, a video magnifier could help make keeping up with the football a lot easier. You can adjust magnification levels, change color modes, and change color text, helping you to check the channel, kickoff times, and match details with more confidence. If you'd like to try a video magnifier or find out any more about other low vision equipment, Beacon Sight Loss Advisors are here to help. You can get in touch at 01902880111 or send us an email, inquiries@beaconvision.org. And don't forget, our Vision Aid Technology Limited Demonstration Day is coming up on Tuesday, the 15th of September at Beacon from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. You'll be able to try a range of solutions, including task lighting, magnifiers, and devices that can read information aloud, with a friendly vision aid specialist on hand to demonstrate the technology and answer any questions you might have. There's no need to book, so just drop in on the day between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. That's it for this week. Join me again next week with more updates. But for now, a goodbye and have a great week.
Thanks for that update, Mohammed. Next up, we have another block of local news.
It sounds like one of Rudolph's Black Country mates, Comet, Blitzen, Prancer, Dancer and the Dudley Dasher. But this festive sounding idea could be more than just a Boston name. Early proposals for a new metro link could see Stourbridge, Briley Hill and Dudley joined up by light rail, giving local journeys a bit more sparkle and a lot less faff. The line would link Stourbridge, Briley Hill and ultimately Dudley by rail, making better use of railway infrastructure which already exists in the area. A proposed route has been released, showing how the proposed light rail service could join up with existing transport links and connect the Black Country. The proposed route would connect up with both the existing Stourbridge Shuttle and upcoming West Midlands Metro. It is a long-running proposal by Pre-Metro Operations, the company that has operated the Stourbridge Junction to Town Shuttle for 17 years. Councillor for Wollaston and Stourbridge Town, Andrew Southall, said, "I'm supportive of the Dudley Dasher because I think there is a clear gap in our local transport network. Stourbridge has very good rail connections into Birmingham and beyond, but travelling across the borough towards Briley Hill and Dudley is considerably less straightforward. What particularly interests me about the Dasher proposal is the prospect of making better use of railway infrastructure which already exists between Stourbridge and Briley Hill. rather than starting from scratch with an enormously expensive new transport project. The proposal is still at the feasibility and business case stage, so naturally I would want to see the detailed costs, engineering work and passenger case properly scrutinised, and I would also be keen to explore opportunities for private investment and partnership rather than simply assuming that the taxpayer should meet the entire cost. However, I think the potential benefits are substantial enough that the scheme absolutely deserves serious investigation. He also supports exploring private investment opportunities to reduce reliance on public funding. The origin of the proposals came in 2019 when Pre-Metro and Oakham Research carried out public consultation and surveys involving more than 1,400 residents in Stourbridge and Briley Hill. Around 87% of respondents said they would support and use the service. Kat Eccles, MP for Stourbridge, recently hosted representatives from Pre-Metro at Dudley Council House alongside Dudley Council higher-ups and other transport officials. The meeting brought together organisations that play a significant role in shaping the future of transport and infrastructure across Dudley and the wider West Midlands, providing an opportunity to discuss how the Dasher proposal could fit with existing and future regional programmes. And if the Dudley Dasher has got rail fans jingling all the way, don't uncouple just yet. Our next story keeps the Black Country firmly on track, as a piece of Wolverhampton's old low-level station is set to chuff off for a second life with the Severn Valley Railway. Talk about recycling with a proper bit of clank, character and Black Country pride.
Steelwork reclaimed from the former Wolverhampton low-level station will get a new lease of life at the Severn Valley Railway as part of a project to upgrade its Kidderminster station. The ornate metalwork salvaged from low-level station, which closed in 1981, will be incorporated into a planned new canopy over the platforms at the Heritage Railway. The scheme has been praised by Wolverhampton Councillor Simon Bennett, who said he was delighted that part of the city's heritage would live on at the Severn Valley. The railway's Kidderminster station, which opened in 1984, is a reproduction of how a Great Western Railway station would have looked prior to nationalisation of the railways in the 1940s. A large glazed canopy was built over the concourse in 2006, and it is hoped the new canopy over the platforms will mark the completion of the project. About 10% of the new canopy will be made from the steelwork reclaimed from low level, preserving an important piece of the city's rich railway heritage for future generations. The completed canopy will provide improved shelter for passengers while becoming a striking architectural feature in its own right. Councillor Bennett said, "This is exactly the sort of heritage preservation project that deserves to be celebrated. Wolverhampton has a proud railway history, and while it's a shame that so much of low-level station has been lost over the years, it's fantastic to know that part of it will live on, rather than being left to deteriorate or disappear altogether." He said the Severn Valley Railway had an outstanding reputation for preserving railway heritage, and the project was a wonderful example of that work in action. "Reusing original Victorian steelwork isn't just sustainable, it ensures an authentic piece of Wolverhampton's history continues to be appreciated by thousands of visitors every year. As someone with a passion for railways and railway preservation, I know just how much these original features mean to enthusiasts and local people alike. Once our railway heritage is lost, we cannot replace it. So projects like this are incredibly important." The Severn Valley Railway has launched an appeal to raise £1 million towards the cost of the project, and Councillor Bennett urged people to donate. About 70 tonnes of steel will go into the new canopy, which will provide improved shelter for passengers while becoming a striking architectural feature in its own right. Severn Valley Chief Executive Gus Dunster said, "Kidderminster is the front door of the Severn Valley Railway, and this project will make it a gateway worthy of what lies beyond. Canopy will transform the welcome we can give our visitors, making a wait on the platform part of the experience itself. It will strengthen the sense of arrival at one of Britain's leading heritage railways and enhance the station for everyone who visits. Judith Meredith, chairman of the Seven Valleys Railway Trust, said, "It feels like we're finally putting the last missing piece into place at Kidderminster. This is an aspirational project that will transform the platform and complete the original vision for the station." Wolverhampton Low Level Station, behind the present station, which was previously known as High Level, closed to passenger service in March 1972, but remained in use as a parcel depot until 1981. The main station building is now used as a banqueting hall, with flats and a Premier Inn hotel also occupying the site. To donate to the project, please see the website www.svrtrust.org.uk/raise the roof.
And there is more news from the Severn Valley Railway, where the Heritage Line is not only set to give new life to steelwork from Wolverhampton's former low-level station, but also welcome the return of a 1930s locomotive to mainline service later this year. Severn Valley Railway and the Stanier Mogul Fund have agreed the return of the Stanier Mogul LMS number 13268 under a new arrangement with Vintage Trains, based at Tyseley in Birmingham. The deal will see the popular locomotive hauling mainline rail tours once again, alongside its ongoing appearances on the Severn Valley Railway between Bridgnorth and Kidderminster. Built in January 1934, the locomotive originally entered service as number 13268, before being renumbered to 968 the following year. Following the nationalisation of Britain's railways in 1948, it became number 42968. At the end of its British Railways career, it was sent to Woodham Brothers Scrapyard in Barry, where it survived as the only remaining example of its class. The Stanier Mogul Fund was established in 1971 with the aim of preserving the locomotive. It was purchased in 1973 and moved to Bridgnorth on the Severn Valley Line. Following restoration, it returned to steam in 1990 and entered passenger service the following year. Apart from periods out of traffic for overhaul, the locomotive gave many years of service until 2013, including hauling mainline rail tours. After its most recent overhaul, it returned to traffic in 2023 temporarily as 2968, before emerging from the Severn Valley Railway paint shop in April 2024, carrying its original LMS number 13268 for the first time in more than 80 years. Gus Dunster, Chief Executive Officer of the Severn Valley Railway, said, "It's going to be fantastic to see 13268 back out on the national network, hauling prestigious mainline rail tours once again. It's a striking locomotive that's hugely popular with our visitors and has become a stalwart of both our regular services and special events. We're delighted to be working in partnership with Vintage Trains and the Stanier Mogul Fund to make this happen. This collaboration ensures the locomotive can continue to delight passengers both on the Severn Valley Railway and on the national network, giving even more people the opportunity to experience this remarkable survivor in action." Peter Holder, chairman of Stanier Mogul Fund, added, "Everyone involved with the Stanier Mogul Fund is immensely proud to see 13268 returning to the national network. Our founders rescued this locomotive from Barry over 50 years ago, and generations of members, volunteers, and supporters have worked tirelessly to ensure that the sole surviving Stanier Mogul remains an operational ambassador for Britain's railway heritage." Seeing the locomotive back on the main line is another significant milestone in its remarkable preservation story, and we're grateful to both the Severn Valley Railway and Vintage Trains for working with us to make this possible. And steaming ahead with more of the sights, sounds and stories of the Severn Valley Railway, we now hand over to someone who knows just how special a day on the rails can be. Beacon's Talking News contributor, volunteer and railway enthusiast, David Smith. David was lucky enough to soak up the atmosphere at the Severn Valley Railway's Diesel Festival earlier this summer, and he joins us now to share the experience.
My day on the Severn Valley Railway. I visited the Severn Valley Railway on day two of their four-day Spring Diesel Gala event, which ran from Thursday the 14th of May to Sunday the 17th of May. The first locomotive I got pulled by was a Class 35 diesel hydraulic engine, number D7018 in green livery. There were 101 of this class built to work on the western region of British Railways and were used on passenger and freight duties. The last of the class to be withdrawn was in 1975. Four of the class are preserved. The second locomotive I had haulage by was a Class 20, number 2189, which was in BR Rail Blue. A total of 228 were built by English Electric, mainly for freight duties, but they did work some passenger services too. I then had haulage behind a locomotive of my favourite class, which was a Class 55 Delta, this being 55009 Elicidon. 22 of these powerful locomotives were built by English Electric between 1961 and 1962 to work passenger services on the East Coast Main Line between London, King's Cross, Edinburgh, Leeds, Bradford and Hull. Six are in preservation. My fourth and final haulage was behind a Class 50, number 50035 Ark Royal. English Electric built 50 of these locomotives in 1968 to work the London Euston to Glasgow services, which they worked from Crewe to Glasgow after taking over from an electric locomotive which worked the train from London. By 1974, the line from Crewe to Glasgow was electrified and the entire Class 50 fleet was transferred to the Western Region to work the London Paddington to Bristol, Plymouth and Penzance services. In the 30-year period that I've been visiting the Severn Valley Railway, I've seen a wide range of diesel locomotives, such as Class 08, 14, 17, 20, 24, 25, 27, 31, 33, 35, 37, 40, 44, 45, 46, 47, 50, 52, 55, 56, 59 and 73. The Severn Valley Railway runs from Kidderminster to Bridge North and is 60 miles long. I'm hoping to carry on visiting the line for many years to come, when the autumn and spring diesel galas are held.
Now it's time to test your knowledge. Here come the quiz questions for this edition.
Time for another quiz now with me, Roger Brooks. As usual, 10 questions, kicking off with this one. Number 1. Who was the famous leader of the famous Dambusters? Question 2. This is perhaps an easier one. Which is the well-known airport in West Sussex? Question 3. Geography again. What is the capital of the Falklands? Capital of the Falklands. Question 4. who played Hannibal Lecter in the 1992 film Silence of the Lambs? Question 5. One for the beer lovers. Which southern brewery makes London Pride? Question 6. Which is the biggest lake in England? The biggest lake in England. Question 7. TV. Who played Manuel in Fawlty Towers? Question 8. Which city was the birthplace of Guy Fawkes and the death place of Dick Turpin? Number 9. Which aristocrat was implicated in the murder of his children's nanny and then disappeared? And question 10, another Beatles question this time. What is Paul McCartney's middle name? Sir Paul McCartney's middle name. Best of luck with those.
We're delighted to introduce a brand new gardening series on the Black Country Talking News. Beacon's Talking News contributor and volunteer Peter invites us into the much-loved gardens at his home in the Black Country, taking us on a wonderfully descriptive tour through a colourful haven of flowers, shrubs, plants, and carefully tended spaces. Along the way, Peter captures his garden's unique character, from fragrant blooms and fascinating textures to the gentle sounds of nature and even the occasional flower, whose scent, to put it politely, certainly makes its presence known. Set against the backdrop of an impressive brick wall, once part of a Victorian walled garden, the series brings this special space vividly to life for us all. Introducing episode 1 of Pottering in the Garden with Peter.
Hello and welcome to this series of talks about my garden in Wolverhampton. I shall describe my garden and talk about the trees and the shrubs and the flowers and the vegetables in it and tell you about the tasks I have to do to keep it as I want it to be. And I'm a bit fussy, I must admit. Well, I'm standing in my front garden at the moment and you can probably hear the noise of traffic in the background. The road's quite close. And it's a busy road, and the noise would be louder, except there's a 12-foot wall at the front of my garden between my land and the road. The wall was part of a Victorian walled garden. The bricks are very old. They're made of a lovely red rough clay. You can see stones in the bricks here and there. And the walled garden was divided into building plots and sold off in the 1930s. And very solid brick archways were built into the wall to allow access to the land behind. So, from the road, you enter through the archway to get into my drive. And this slopes upwards to my house, which is almost in the middle of my land, so that my front garden and my back garden are roughly the same size. Well, the drive is a gravel drive, which has advantages and disadvantages. It means you can hear someone coming up the drive, which could be a bit of a deterrent for would-be burglars, and you can probably hear me as I'm walking on the drive at the moment. But the disadvantage is, in fact, even though there's a weed-proof membrane underneath the gravel, weeds somehow manage to take root. So periodically, I have to have a blitz and pull out or spray the weeds. And because of the slope, the gravel does tend to migrate down to the arch. So occasionally, I have to go out to the pavement and sweep some of the gravel back into the drive. The size of the front garden is roughly 50 foot square, more or less. And as you come in through the arch, there is a flower border on your right running the whole length of the garden. And the drive widens out from the archway to create a large triangle running up to the house. And on the left of that is another triangle, which is obviously the lawn and more flower beds. And there's a retaining wall to these flower beds because they are roughly the same level of the house. And of course, the drives are at a lower level. And this retaining wall I built from bits of stone that were laying around when I first came to this house some 40 years ago. Now, on one side of the house, there's a gate leading to the back garden. On the other side, there's a shed. Well, about 10 years ago, I decided to empty my loft because it was a right pain to get into. And what I didn't throw away, I stored in the shed. Usual loft things. Christmas decorations, suitcases, assorted junk, that sort of thing. And it also acts as an overflow for the kitchen cupboards, storing extra plates and glasses, amongst other stuff. Now, at the front of the house, on the left, there is a large open porch, large enough for me to mount displays of plants throughout the year. At the moment, it's the turn of the hostas, which do well because the porch doesn't get much sun. And I'm very proud of my collection. I have 17 pots of hostas, a number of different varieties. One with very large dark green leaves, a couple with slightly smaller golden green leaves, and a number of green, gold and white variations. Dark green with white edges, green with golden edges, gold leaves with green edges, small glossy green leaves are my favourite. Gold in the centre with dark green and light green edges. There's also two huge ceramic pots on the porch, brown glazed pots with cream slip decorations of dragons. These are full of small daffodil bulbs, which are early flowering and eagerly awaited as a sign of spring. Their vibrant yellow flowers are so beautiful. And when they finish flowering, they're allowed to die back, so they will come again next year. And I plant annuals in the pots for the summer. This year, I planted cosmos seedlings, which my sister gave me. And I have no idea what colour they are, but to me, that's one of the joys of gardening, waiting for a plant to flower and wondering what it's going to look like. So when the hostas start dying back in late autumn, then I fill the space with potted shrubs. I have three types of variegated hebes, and the star of the show, a shrub that I know as Christmas box. It has glossy green leaves, and in January, it has little white flowers that give us the most strong scent. So as you go in and out of the front door, this wonderful smell wafts over you. And then the flowers die back, and black glossy berries take their place. Well, that's all for this week. Next time, I'll be talking in more details about the shrubs, trees and flowers in my front garden.
Now we have to hear what the weather has in store for us. Brought to us, come rain or shine, by our own sunny Mina.
Hi everyone, it's Mina here with your forecast for the week ahead. This time we're looking at the weather across the Black Country from Friday 28th of August through to Thursday 3rd of September. As August draws to a close and September makes its return, the weather appears ready to remind us that summer won't be around forever. The week ahead looks rather mixed, with plenty of cloud, occasional breaks of rain, and temperatures generally hovering in the high teens, although there should be a few brighter spells to lift the mood from time to time. Before we get into the details, there is a noticeable shift in the overall pattern compared with warmer and drier conditions many of us enjoyed earlier this month. We've moved towards something a little more typical that changes seasons with more frequent opportunities for rainfall and fewer prolonged sunny spells. That doesn't mean every day will be wet by any means, but keeping a brolly nearby would be a sensible mood for the week ahead. Friday starts things off on a fairly damp note, with outbreaks of rain likely at times and plenty of cloud around. Temperatures should reach around 18 degrees, so while it won't feel cold, it's certainly not shorts and barbecue weather. Whether you're heading into Wolverhampton city centre, popping over to Merry Hill, or simply trying to dodge the puddles While searching for the back-to-school essentials, the Waterproofs may get their first outing of the week. Sunrise will be around 5:12 a.m. with sunset near 7:07 p.m. giving us a gentle reminder that those long summer evenings are slowly starting to slip away. Saturday looks a little brighter, although cloud is likely to remain a frequent visitor. Most places should enjoy some decent dry spells, with temperatures reaching around 19 degrees. It's the sort of day where you'll spend half an hour deciding whether to take a coat, only to discover the weather has changed its mind before you've reached the front gate. Sunday continues in a similar vein, with a mixture of cloud and occasional bright intervals. Then we may have the odd shower drifting through, but many places should remain dry for much of the day. Temperatures are expected to reach around 18 degrees, making it perfectly respectable weather for a stroll around the park, a visit to the local attraction, or simply watching someone else mow their lawn while feeling pleased that you don't have to. As we move into Bank Holiday Monday, the final day of August looks largely cloudy but generally settled for most of the region. Temperatures should reach around 19 degrees. And while sunshine may make occasional appearance, there should still be some decent dry periods. Sunrise will be around 5:17 a.m. with sunset close to 7 p.m. bringing the curtain down on the meteorological summer, which runs from 1st of June to 31st of August. Tuesday marks the arrival of September, and the new month appears keen to make an entrance with a distinctly autumnal flavour. Outbreaks of rain are possible through the day, although temperatures should remain fairly comfortable at around 20 degrees. If August left us reaching for the sun cream, September may have us reaching for the umbrella instead. Wednesday theme continues changeable. Further showers or periods of light rain and possible mixed with cloud skies and occasional brighter breaks. Temperatures should stay close to 20 degrees. So despite the unsettled conditions, it won't feel particularly chilly. It's the kind of weather that pairs beautifully with a hot drink and a good excuse to stay indoors little longer than planned. By Thursday, we should begin to see a slightly brighter end to the forecast period. Some sunnier intervals are expected to develop as clouds start to break up, with temperatures around 19 degrees. It may not feel like the height of summer, but it should offer a more cheerful finish to the week than the weather we've experienced at the start of it. By Thursday, 3rd of September, sunrise will be around 5:23 a.m. and set near 6:52 p.m., highlighting just how noticeably our daylight hours are shortening now as autumn begins to find its feet. So overall, the outlook for the Black Country over the next 7 days is for rather mixed weather. Temperatures will generally range between 18 to 20 degrees. There'll be plenty of cloud around, several opportunities for rain, and only occasional bright spells. It's very much a week that sits between the seasons. It's still reluctant to leave the stage comfortably, but autumn has definitely arrived early and is already waiting in the wings. As always, forecasts can change, particularly several days ahead. So it's worth checking for updates if you've got important plans. But for now, the message is simple. Keep the brolly handy, make the most of any sunshine when it appears, and don't be too surprised if the weather changes its mind once or twice before lunchtime. Have a wonderful week and enjoy the brighter spells whenever they come along. Stay safe and remember, in the Black Country, the weather forecast isn't a promise, it's more strongly worded suggestions.
Now it's time to find out how our local football teams have been getting on.
Now then, what were you doing 489 days ago? Chances are, Wolves were winning their last away league game. That's how long the wait had been. So, when nearly 6,000 supporters headed up to Lancashire on Saturday, they were chasing more than 3 points. They were chasing the end of a very long drought. Wolves swapped opening night chaos for away day class, and their travelling army were rewarded in style. After the dramatic 2-2 draw with Blackburn, Cesar Peixoto demanded greater control from his side. At Deepdell, he got it. Roared on by around 5,600 Wolves fans, the Old Goal produced their most complete performance of the season so far, beating Preston North End 3-1 and finally ending that 489-day wait for an away league victory. The outstanding Fer Lopez opened the scoring with a dazzling solo effort after just 8 minutes, racing clear before finding the net with real conviction. Substitute Adam Armstrong then showed exactly why Wolves brought him in. Slotting home after neat work with Raul Jimenez, Lopez returned late in the game to complete his brace and put the result beyond doubt, before Jordan Thompson's stoppage time strike gave Preston a consolation they scarcely deserved. More importantly, Wolves looked balanced. They pressed intelligently, defended with authority, and carried a threat whenever they moved forward. The travelling support, who packed out the away end from first whistle to last, finally had an away day victory to celebrate again. And while Wolves were breaking a hoodoo in Lancashire, Albion were making a serious statement back home. James Morrison's Baggies didn't just beat Burnley, they outplayed them. An early setback arrived when Callum Stiles accidentally turned into his own net, but Albion's response was immediate and impressive. Youngster Harry Whitwell levelled with his first championship goal before Isaac Price produced the moment of the afternoon, rifling home a superb strike seconds after the restart. Price then added his second from the penalty spot to seal a hugely encouraging 3-1 victory over one of the division's fancied promotion contenders. There were standout performances everywhere. Jimmy J. Morgan supplied the assist for Whitwell's leveller and played a key role in Albion's second goal, as the Hawthorns crowd watched a side playing with confidence and purpose. 2 games, 2 wins, 6 points. Morrison could hardly have asked for a better league start. The takeaway? Wolves finally ended an away day drought that felt like it might last forever, while Albion announced themselves as genuine contenders with a commanding win over Burnley. One found freedom on the road, the other found another gear entirely. Up next, Wolves return to Molineux to face Stoke City, while Albion travel to Middlesbrough looking to make it 3 championship wins from 3. Early days, certainly, but across the Black Country, optimism is starting to feel fully justified. And from championship promotion pushes to sporting achievement of a very different kind. In our next feature, we're showing a spotlight on the Cheshire Cobras' visually impaired cricket team, reflecting on a season packed with success, determination and team spirit. More than just results on a scoreboard, it's a story about confidence, friendship, inclusion and the life-changing impact that accessible sport can have for people living with sight loss. We'll hear about the highs of the season, the challenges overcome and why visually impaired cricket continues to open doors both on and off the field. With special thanks to Beacon contributor and volunteer Mina, whose passion and dedication helped bring this inspiring story together.
Hi, it's Mina on the Black Country Talking News. Today we've got a really inspiring story from the world of sport, visually impaired cricket with Cheshire Cobras. This is their first year in the Development League and they've done brilliantly to finish in second place. That's a huge achievement for the team. I'm joined today by two people who have been at the heart of it. First, the chairman of the Cheshire Cobras, David Knowles. David not only helps run the club, he also plays for the team, and the team captain Michael Harrison, who leads the side on the pitch. We'll hear from both of them about what this season has meant, how it feels to come second in their first year, and how they work together with the team. Let's hear from them now.
My name's Dave Knowles. I'm the chairman of Cheshire Cobras Visually Impaired Cricket Club. We form the VI team that's associated with Cheshire Cricket Board's disability sections. I've been chairman now for the past six seasons, taking over mid-2020. First got involved with the club pretty much as it was formed back in 2013. I attended a few training sessions, taster sessions with the Northern Galloways, which then was part of the Northwest VI Cricket Board, which we then kind of formed Cheshire Cobras out of. Previous to that, I had a little exposure to VI cricket. We used to do an annual staff first student cricket match when I was at RNC in Hereford between 2006 and 2010. That was about the most cricket experience that I'd ever had. I've always been of the opinion that there's an opportunity to do something that you enjoy in any form, then just get on and do it. Work out how to do that afterwards. VI cricket for me has been very much a social thing. I enjoy getting out on the field with others that just enjoy cricket. And do it for the same reason that I do. Getting together, having fun, having a laugh, enjoying a pint with friends at the end of the day. This has been the case since the staff student matches. It's all about just enjoying it. Obviously, the winning has to come in somewhere, and I've been very lucky to have a team that over the years has worked hard and celebrated hard. From friendlies against regular sighted teams, providing VI cricket awareness, to national T20 finalists and 30 over cup semi-finalists. Now, in our first league season, finishing second and back in the National T20 semi-finals, North Regional T20 final, we've been through a fair amount and I wouldn't change it for the world. VI cricket, at least the domestic game that we play in the UK, is very akin to regular cricket. Obviously, there's adaptations, big white stumps, size through football, volleyball, with beads inside for audibility, as close to regular over-arm bowling as possible with a heavy ball, plus some concessions depending on sight level. For example, blind people and low-sighted people, ball has to bounce twice, but not end up rolling before the ball reaches the crease where they're batting from. Totally blind people are allowed to catch the ball off a single bounce, whereas everyone else has to catch off no bounce, pretty much the same as regular cricket. Obviously, it would be catastrophic if blind people were to run between the wickets after hitting the ball, so there are required runners, also visually impaired as part of the team, to make their runs for them, and they score double runs. Fantastic for a team if a blind person magnificently hits a six and racks up 12 runs. Unlikely, but not unheard of. There's no real age, gender or capability limit. Anyone can play. If you've got an eye condition that classifies you as being partially sighted or blind, you can play. We've had people quite good sight to no sight. Teenagers to people in their 70s, from all walks of life. There really isn't much of a restriction at all on VI cricket. Getting involved isn't hard, just get in touch with us. We often run taster sessions and training sessions with nets throughout the summer and winter, and we're always on the lookout for new players. So just find us on Facebook at Cheshire Cobras, or drop us a message, or send us an email at chairman@cheshirecobras.co.uk or treasurer@cheshirecobras.co.uk, and we'll see what we can do to help.
Hello, my name is Mike Harrison, and I'm the captain of Cheshire Cobras Visually Impaired Cricket Club. I'm immensely proud and privileged to be the captain and to have been elected to lead the Cheshire Cobras squad this season in our very first dip into national competition. As captain, I mostly have an on-field leadership role. This is supplemented by other players who help me set fields and decide batting lineups. In training, I and other senior players look to help the team improve technical ability and the mental approach to the game. On match days, my role can go from anything from pumping up footballs to passing out kit, wristbands, shades and the like, to making decisions on the pitch. I have a very relaxed approach to my captaincy, but I do try to make sure the players have fun, enjoy their cricket, and I try to tell them to go out and play to the best of their abilities. The most pleasing thing this season has been our victory over Birmingham Stars in the Midland Regional T20 competition. Birmingham are a very difficult team to play, and our team spirit saw us through a difficult run chase. I think it's been a great season for the club. This is our first season playing in the development regional cricket, and to finish second was a great achievement. We also managed to go through the season unbeaten. I do think the team has progressed and grown as the season has gone on. I've seen players come through that raised their abilities and shown that they're up to playing at this level. Obviously, there's still room to improve for all of us going forward, but I do think that we are building something that can succeed as we move forward in successive seasons. This team has got a really good, strong squad.
What a fantastic story for Cheshire Cobras. A huge thank you to the chairman and player David Knowles and the captain Michael Harrison for sharing their journey with us today. Finishing second in their first Development League year is something to be truly proud of. If you'd like to find out more about the Cheshire Cobras, I'm sure they'd love to hear from you. I'm Mina, and you've been listening to the Black Country Talking News.
And with thanks to TNF Soundings contributor Liz, we have the final episode of a three-part series about one of our greatest storytellers and the author of Treasure Island, Robert Louis Stevenson.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Is it wise for a man who had a bad chest to spend his honeymoon in a mining shack? You can decide that for yourself. But money was not yet coming in for his writing. They returned to the UK, where Fanny charmed the Stevenson parents. They were given money. They were given a home that they could live in near Bournemouth for quite a stretch of time, where our Robert met Henry James and also wrote the bulk of the novel that became Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. But yet they were restless, and of course they still yet were struggling for money. But they were back to the States, they were living an erratic life, and then he had success with a stage version of Jekyll and Hyde, and then his father passed away, and at that point the money worries were over, and they could indulge the restless spirit because they now had finances. He wrote, he yearned to visit the Parrot Islands of the Pacific. And that's what they did together for the next 3 years, wandering New Zealand, Australia, Tahiti, Hawaii, and settling on Samoa. Was Samoa the idyllic South Sea paradise they had expected? No. Samoa by the 1880s, the 1890s, was a hotbed of local chiefs in prison, intertribal clashes, and the ever-growing interest of large powers in these tiny islands. America wanted control of Samoa. Isn't that topical? Germany wanted control of Samoa. And of course, Britain, the Britain of the Empire, was interested in Samoa as well. At this point, our Robert was writing, an ill man was writing 5 hours a day. And the remaining parts of the day, he was writing letters to the London Times to complain about the British government. He was writing letters to the British government directly. At such a depth and at such anger, he was threatened at one point with being removed from the island. But through this, the Stevensons managed to prosper. They built a house on a estate called Vailima. And through all their struggles, they showed themselves to be people of surpassing kindness to the population of Samoa. In fact, they were described in many ways as being like Highland chieftains of an idyllic past of Brigadoon type unreality. He wanted to be a Cameron of Lochiel. Despite these joys in their home in Samoa, the ill health continued. Oh, by the way, he also had a stepson who just took money, a stepson-in-law who also took money and several mistresses, and Fanny herself was quite an erratic woman. Mood swings, large purchases, trips to Australia to spend the money that our Robert was now earning through his earnings. I would like to tell you that Robert Louis Stevenson triumphed over his ill health, but I can't. By the age of 44, he was a thin, thin, ill man. He took a stroke in 1894 and passed away. There was dreadful sadness among the local people of Samoa upon his death. And in fact, they built an extra road from their estate up to the hillside where his tomb was placed and where it is till this day. Robert Louis Stevenson, the political activist, in fact, had been very aware of the position of these small islands. And 8 years after his death, the islands themselves were partitioned between America and Germany. But to end, I think, on a positive note, although it's a sombre account, Robert Louis Stevenson did find peace in Samoa. And in fact, he wrote the beautiful words that are engraved on his tomb to this day. And I'd like to finish the story of his life with these few lines that he wrote. Under the wide and starry sky, dig the grave and let me lie. Glad did I live and gladly die, and I laid me down with a will. This be the verse you grave for me. Here he lies where he longed to be. Home is the sailor, home from the sea, and the hunter home from the hill. That's my choice. Robert Louis Stevenson.
TNF Soundings.
Now, here come the quiz
answers.
And they're brought to us by Mina.
Roger back now with the answers to our 10 questions quiz. Who was the leader of the Dambusters on that daring raid? It was Wing Commander Guy Gibson. And still sort of in the air, but on the ground. Which is the famous airport in West Sussex? That, of course, is Gatwick. Gatwick. Number 3, the capital of the Falklands is Port Stanley. Port Stanley. Question 4, the infamous murderer Hannibal Lecter in the 1992 film was played by Anthony Hopkins. Anthony Hopkins. Question 5. London Pride beer is brewed by Fuller's, F-U-L-L-E-R-S. Question 6. The biggest lake in England is Windermere. Question 7. Manuel, the faulty waiter in Fawlty Towers, was played by Andrew Sachs. Andrew Sachs. Question 8. York was the city that was the birthplace of Guy Fawkes and the place where Dick Turpin, famous highwayman robber, was executed. Question 9. The famous aristocrat for whom the search has never really ended, implicated in the murder of his children's nanny, was Lord Lucan. Lord Lucan. And question 10, bit of a trick one, this. Paul McCartney's middle name is Paul. His full name is James Paul McCartney. Hope you did well on those.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. Thank you for listening. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us. Stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra!